All right, we're ready to get going. Welcome to everybody. How's everybody doing? Is the conference going well? Good. Welcome. For the next hour and 15 minutes, we're going to talk about third-party JavaScript libraries you need to know. Well, or maybe just third-party JavaScript libraries that I think you need to know. Before we get rolling, I just give you 2 seconds on myself here. This is what I affectionately refer to as my NASCAR slide. The long and short on me is that I have been a professional SharePoint developer for the last decade. I really don't do anything but SharePoint all day long since 2003. So I was one of those guys who was at the first SharePoint conference. Anybody else at the first SharePoint conference? Hey, veterans, way to go. All right, so this is just a few of the books that I've been involved with and some of the company logos that you might find my name under. If I haven't met you, please feel free to come up to me during the week and introduce yourself. I'd love to meet all you guys and talk about the topics that we're discussing. My sort of mini theme for the conference, the one that I've been bringing to every one of my talks, is what I call from bricks to houses, from bricks to houses. And I call it this because our relationship with SharePoint 2010 in the past has been what I liken to building bricks for a wall. Our relationship with SharePoint 2010 is very intimate. We go in there and we create features that really extend the product. So I like to think the features that we made in SharePoint 2010, you know, they could have been made by the SharePoint team. They fit into the product the same way the core features do. It's just that the Microsoft guys chose not to make them, or they're very specific to what we do. But the key here is that our relationship was very, very intimate, and as such, we could take advantage of many things that SharePoint had to offer, and we were sort of building these bricks that plugged into SharePoint. Now what we're doing is really building more of the entire house, and by that I mean that your relationship with SharePoint is not so intimate anymore. It becomes this resource that you can use, that you can call out to. And so the message I'm trying to drive home to everyone is you're really, really, really much more becoming a web developer who focuses on using resources that are available from SharePoint, as opposed to a SharePoint developer who had highly specialized knowledge. And as I was discussing with a couple of people in between sessions today, while we were all specializing in SharePoint, the web and cloud developers were busy developing new technologies and expertise that we didn't think we needed to care about. And now we've arrived at the place where we do, and we're a little behind. So that's what these sessions are really all about, is the knowledge gap that you have that goes beyond just the app model and into the skills that are necessary to be a SharePoint developer going forward. Okay, so for this talk, right, I couldn't show you every single JavaScript library available, so what I did was I picked some, and I have my own selection criteria, so they have to support this idea of building houses, and by that I really specifically mean support for enterprise JavaScript development patterns. One of the things that I feel our community is really struggling with right now is our relationship with JavaScript and how are we going to use it to make enterprise scalable applications. If we're really honest with each other, probably what we've done with JavaScript as SharePoint developers is used it in little ways that we don't want to tell anybody we used it, to glue stuff together in SharePoint when we couldn't figure out how other stuff works, and I can see a few of you laughing, right? So we just stick a little here, stick a little there, make it work, a little jQuery, and that's good. But really what we have to become now are folks that understand how to make entire apps out of nothing but JavaScript, and these are enterprise apps that are scalable and service thousands of people. That's a big challenge for us as a community, I think. So that's part of the selection criteria, and also support for responsive design. There was a great session in here just ahead of me on doing responsive design in SharePoint, and they were focused on doing it in, you know, in SharePoint proper with master pages and page layouts. We're going to talk about how to do responsive design for the apps that you build. The libraries I chose couldn't be obvious, so no jQuery. I hope that everybody in here has some understanding of jQuery. I didn't do TypeScript, although it's important. It's something that has a lot of play in other places, and in fact, there's a session on it as well. They have to be free, so I wanted to make it so everybody could go grab them and use them. And there's a couple of honorable mentions I'll get out of the way right out the gate here. Modernizer.js. Modernizer is a library that allows you to detect HTML5 capabilities. I referenced it in my previous talk. It's a very simple library, but your best friend, because you need to understand the browsers that are touching your apps and what they're capable of doing so that you can either use HTML5 capabilities or come up with some workaround. Underscore, you'll see some underscore code in one of the samples. Underscore is a utility function library that does really neat stuff with collections and arrays and allows you to write link style syntax against collections and arrays and makes your life really pleasurable. So that's a good one. You'll see some code in one of my samples. And Toaster, which is a really simple library for doing toast notifications, you know, the little pop-ups in your apps. So those are my honorable mentions, three that are definitely worth looking at. I won't spend a tremendous amount of time on them. Our agenda in the session, though, is broken out into three main sections: data access libraries, app pattern libraries, and responsive design. So in the data access, we're talking about Data.js and Breeze. Obviously, we're going to go into detail on all these going forward. In the app pattern section, we're going to look at what does it take to build in model view, view model with Knockout, or single page applications under model view controller with Angular. In responsive design, we're going to talk about enhanced CSS with less support for less, and also, and very importantly, the use of Bootstrap in responsive design. And as I said, that was covered a lot in the last session as well. Okay, so jumping right in, we're going into data access libraries. First one we want to talk about is Data.js. Data.js. So Data.js is a library that targets OData sources. So if you have an OData source that you want to use, then this is an OData client that you can utilize. Now, why do you care about this? Well, you care about this for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, what we get back from SharePoint when we do REST calls is OData, right? So SharePoint exposes OData to us. Open data is a specification specifically for creating RESTful services that perform CRUD operations. So it turns out this is a really important part of our app development life because SharePoint lists what we're doing typically is performing CRUD operations against them. And what you're going to find as you go along is that if it makes sense to be doing these things against SharePoint lists and sources, then it also makes sense to be doing them against non-SharePoint sources. And this is a place where I hear absolutely no conversation in the SharePoint community. If I'm going to consume RESTful services from SharePoint, it makes total sense that I should be consuming my own custom databases in exactly the same way. So once I get into that pattern, if you buy into my argument that life is client-side programming over HTTP to back-end OData sources, then you now want to be in the business of writing your own RESTful services, which I'll do in another session that we have. But that's why OData is important. So this isn't just like, well, oh, there's an OData library. This is the type of data that we talk to. You can get this thing off of CodePlex. Every one of the ones that I'll show you today is also available as a NuGet package, so the easiest way to get them, right-click in Visual Studio. What are the features? It's an OData client that works cross-browser. So this is a really important thing, right? Because we have all these different browsers to support. And if we're going to say OData is our data standard, then I want to be able to support it across various browsers without having to write a bunch of patch code. And Data.js has that for us. It also has very strong data caching power. So what it's going to allow us to do is bring data down onto our client and execute against the cache rather than to continue to make calls back to, say, the RESTful service or the SharePoint list and perform a lot of operations against the cache and then ultimately perform batch operations against the back end. Now, unfortunately, I'll say right out of the front here is that the lists in SharePoint don't support batch operations, so we have some weaknesses there in some of the things that I'll show you. But when we write our own RESTful services, we can certainly support batch operations. It's remarkably easy to use. If you've done anything with jQuery, you'll recognize sort of the syntax here. So instead of a jQuery AJAX request, what we're doing is looking at an OData request. And you can see, however, that we have very familiar syntax here where we have a request URI. This one happens to be targeting the item count for a list. So it basically says how many items are in the list. What method is it? What kind of data do I get back? I accept application JSON. As a SharePoint developer now who writes apps, you really have to be very strong in gets and posts and puts and headers and accepts and content types and authorization tokens. This is the new data world that we live in. If we want to cache data, then Data.js will allow us to do that. You can see this data.js create cache method that I'm calling where I can name my cache and then say what the source is. Here you see the source is a contacts list. And basically what's happening here, note the page size at the bottom, I'm downloading the entire list into a cache, and then I can perform the rest of my operations against the items in that list. So if I want to navigate through them, it becomes very easy to do that using the read cache that you see down here. Read cache, where am I going to start? How many things do I want? Then execute this function, which means that the cache is very useful for paging through large sets of data. Again, SharePoint lacks the ability to do batch updates, but if you're performing something, working with an app that's primarily reading and showing data, then you can download most of it when you get started and then page through it, and it makes for a very pleasant user experience. And then you can see, of course, the cache clear at the bottom to clear the cache out. Okay, so pretty simple to do. Let's take a look at a demo of this in action. Okay, so switch over here to, make sure I get the right one. Does that look like wrong? Looks right, okay. Okay, so what we're gonna do is I've got a solution here, and now a lot of the solutions I'm gonna run for you involve my own RESTful service. So I'll do some against SharePoint lists and libraries, things like that, but we'll also create our own. So I have a web API OData source in here, and that's what you see down here as data.js service. So this is a source. And then I have an app that I wrote that consumes it. So above it is the SharePoint app. So what I can do after I write my own OData source in web API is just go ahead and fire this thing up. So we'll give it a start. And then we're also going to run, with our demos here, we're going to run Fiddler so we can take a look at some of the action that's going on behind the scenes. Now, when my OData source fires up, you'll notice that it has a home page here. Well, I'm using ASP.NET, MVC, and specifically Web API. And in that model, I can mix web pages and OData endpoints. So when this thing fires up, it's simply stopping on a home page here. But the service is running. And the way that this thing works is that you can go against the OData source. So if I come in here and just, let's just copy the URL out so we can kind of see what's going on. So there's the root of my little project there in localhost. But the OData endpoint is a customer's endpoint, and it's located at odata/customers, like that. And I can go hit it. Oh, yes, and of course, we have to do something like that. Let's see if I got it right. Yeah, I like it, but it doesn't like me. Did I misspell it? Yes, because spelling counts. Customer. You know, it's hard to use the computer when you're standing up, right? Okay, there we go. Like that better? Yeah, it's turning now. Life looks good. Okay, and then if I go ahead and open up the response here, you'll see that what I got was a JSON response from that service. So this is what's going on, and this is the new world in which we live in. We're going to create things like this that allow us to get JSON responses back. And then, in fact, if I go into Fiddler, we can come down here and kind of look for the OData customers line right there. Click on it. We'll come over here and say we'd like to see the JSON result. I'm clicking on it. Where am I? The wrong one? Listen, you're already telling me I'm on the wrong one. Let's clear it out. They're like, use a Mac. Remember that ad? All right, there we go. Did we do it? Oh, he's killing me. All right, we're close. Customers. Was that the misspelling one? Is that what it was? Is that what you're trying to tell me? Okay, there's the good one, right? All right, perfect. Love it. So now we can go into Fiddler, which keeps track of all the operations back and forth. We can ask to see the result in JSON, and you can see that, in fact, what I did was perform a get operation against that OData source, and here it is returning OData to me. All right, so that's just to prove that the thing is real. Now what we'll do is let's go to the client that I wrote. So here's our data.js client. Go ahead and click on it. And then you can see that what I've got is an application that is working against that OData. So now, if we come in and look at this thing and kind of scroll down a bit, we've got a lot of activity here in Fiddler. But one of the things I want you to notice is you'll notice that we're not going to be pulling all that information as we work our way through it, because we're actually operating on the cache. So if I come in here and I say, I'd like to go ahead and edit something, right? Now, I could page through all this because it's all in the cache, but if I want to do an edit on something, like we'll just change Merle here to have an E, go ahead and click Update, then you can see that there's our Merle right there, right? And actually, it's really kind of interesting. I don't know if you just caught it, but Brandy just jumped to the top of the list. Did you see that? The reason that happened is because I was fooling around beforehand and the cache data didn't have Brandy in it. But when I did the edit, it actually went and reread the database. So now we can come in here and go down to the very bottom and point out that when I did the edit against customer 12, I refreshed the cache and then went and reread everything. So my point here is that I bring the list into cache, and then I'm going to decide after I perform various operations what when I refresh that and bring it back. So it gives you a lot of control over how the data is managed. All right, so let's go stop debugging and take a look at some of the code. So we really want to focus on the consuming of this. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the service. Again, I'll sort of tease you and say, if you want to know about building the service part, that's the session I'm doing tomorrow. We're focusing more on the consumption part with our JavaScript libraries. And I'm going to come down here and take a look at this library called Wingtip CRM View Model. And inside of here, we're going to start by looking at this right here. So here is the code that actually builds the cache. It's similar to the code that I showed you on the slide. It uses data.js create, and then we're just going to reference the endpoint that we want to go to. So notice I'm referencing that OData customer's endpoint and also providing those OData order by, and I'm ordering by last name and first name and only selecting the top 100. Conveniently, I say I want a page size of 100, so this is going to fill my cache with 100 items from that source. Then what happens is we can take a look at maybe getting a single customer, like when we wanted to do an edit. So if we take a look at getting a single customer, which happens here under Get Customer, what I'm doing now is executing a read range against the cache, which allows me to say where I want to start and what how far I want to go. So now, because this is a demo and I could just kind of cheat a little bit, what I did was I started at 0 and read 100, so I'm pulling back all 100 from the cache. But what happens is you get a promise back from this. And so what that means is that when that read completes, I can specify a function that will run, and it will pass into me the data it pulled from the cache, whether it's one record or 100. So now my challenge in this little part was to pull out just one record that I wanted. So one of our runner-ups is being used here, in which you can see me using the underscore library. Notice the underscore, hence the name underscore. And underscore is really cool because it works against these arrays and collections and allows you to chain operations together. So I take the data and I put it in the chain function. I say I would like to filter that data, and I'd like to see where the contact's ID is equal to ID, which is what I'm passing in. REST says take everything else in the collection beginning at this number. First says give me the first one from there. So basically, I'm just taking the first one that comes back from that filter and then return me the value. So notice how politely this is all chained together. That's what underscore does for you. Makes it very easy. It feels link-like, the way that you're pulling those things out of the array. And then I've got one item back that I can show you. If I do an add, update, or delete, I've chosen to refresh the cache. So for example, if I come in here and do an add, you can see I'm doing an add by doing an OData request. So again, if you've done jQuery Ajax, that syntax should feel familiar to you. I'm passing up in the body of the post the data that I would like to add, and then this also returns a promise, which means I can have success or failure functions, and I'm choosing to refresh the cache on success or failure, okay? So I can't take questions, but I'll do it after we're done. Otherwise, I'll keep going, all right? So that's your first library to look at, Data.js, and you care about it because it's specific to OData, it's cross-browser, and it has this wonderful cache that you can use to download chunks of data and then decide when you want to update it. All right, back to slides. Next on our hit parade is Breeze. I'm super excited about Breeze. I think Breeze is probably the star of this presentation. I really like it a lot. What it does is Breeze brings to us entity modeling and querying. So, you know, when we work with back-end data sources, it always seems like every time there's a data source, we have to have another way to query it, right? So if it's a SharePoint list, it's CAML. If it's OData, I have to know my gets and puts, right? If it's a database, I got to know SQL, right? So why do I have to know all that? It really drives me nuts that I have to know all that. I just want a customer object. Can't somebody just give me a customer object? So the idea of an object relational map is a concept that says I'm going to take these normalized tables and then transform them into an object so that you, the developer, can stop your long-suffering querying problems and just, you know, work with objects directly. So that's really the goal, is what we want to do. We want to get objects back. And Breeze gets us pretty far down the road, really helps us out with this, because it provides this idea of modeling entities and then querying those entities instead of performing queries against a data source. As you can see in the features list, it has modeling and querying, but also has data caching, because it draws a dependency on Data.js. Ah, you see, there's a reason I showed you that. So Data.js is used by Breeze to manage the data caching, but it's even cooler because Breeze does change tracking for you. So as you do adds, updates, and deletes, it tracks those changes in the cache, and then when you go to submit changes back, it replays those changes back to the data, so it only sends the changes that you made back, and it does it in a batch operation. It sounds a lot like what's really cool about Entity Framework, right? So that's what I really like about Breeze. I think it's a big plus for us. Here's a little bit of code to help you understand how it works. What we have to do when we're retrieving OData is, of course, we're referencing the Breeze library up there, so you can see the namespace, breeze.config.initializeAdapterInstances. And the way that this model works is that it works on having different adapters, which is very similar to what we do in Entity Framework and Link, right? You need a different adapter for the different back-end data type, and that's the same kind of model that's going on with Breeze. And so what I'm saying is I want to use an OData adapter against this back-end data source, and then I fire up an entity manager here, and this entity manager is very, very similar to a DB context in Entity Framework. That's going to be the thing that manages and tracks all my entities. I can then create a query, query equals new Breeze entity query from contacts where last name starts with C top 50. Let's pause and let that line of code sink in. Is that cool or what? Now what's, yeah, right? Think about what has to happen in the background to make that reality. That's going to do gets and posts and puts and manage the headers for you, all kinds of stuff like that. And you just write something that looks like link, and you get back information. And then you go manage your execute query, right? So all that feels familiar too. And then you're going to get a promise back, which allows you to have success or failure functions come back. Okay. Behind the scenes, what's happening is the SharePoint app gets loaded, and then Breeze will actually read the metadata service from your OData service. So every OData service is supposed to expose a $ metadata endpoint, which tells you about the schema of the service, the entities that are provided by the OData service, and Breeze will actually read that on the first interaction with the service and create entities for you. Pause and let that sink in. That is cool, right? And then it can use that information to create the entities and allow you to execute the queries. You can see the sort of query that it creates down there where it says execute query, but that's not what we write, that's what Breeze sends, right? So we get that? If we don't want or don't have the ability to have a metadata document that Breeze can use and generate its own entities, then we can define our own custom metadata, which should also sound familiar to you if you've done Entity Framework work. So now we come in here and we create a new metadata store, Breeze metadata store, and we're adding a type to the store. You can see I'm defining a customer. It has an ID, and that ID is an integer that is not nullable. It has a last name that's a string, a first name a string, and an email as a string. So you're defining the model here yourself, and you can tell Breeze, don't go ask for the metadata, I'll define the model, and then it expects that to be there when you go to make the calls. Okay, a little bit of update on Breeze and SharePoint, because this is important. Last Thursday, Breeze did not work with SharePoint. But today, it does, thanks to a lot of really hard work by the folks that are involved in Breeze, and my buddy Andrew Connell, who has been working very hard on a GitHub project to create an adapter that allows this thing to work with SharePoint. SharePoint has some limitations, as I mentioned. For example, it doesn't like batch processing, which Breeze wants to do to be efficient. So they had to do a lot of work under the covers to get SharePoint to work with it. Also, SharePoint uses OData 2 and not OData 3, so some of the form of the data that comes back from SharePoint is different than what Breeze really wants. But I'm happy to report that as of today, there is a working solution to allow you to use Breeze against SharePoint. So now, I mean, do you guys like Link for SharePoint? Do you remember Link for SharePoint? Well, that's like, to me, one of the biggest losses when we had to go client-side. But what Breeze is doing is filling that gap again now. So now you can write Link-style queries from JavaScript. So that's pretty cool. Okay, let's take a look at a demo of that. Wrong one. Six. Yes? Good. Okay. Let's go ahead and open up the code for this one first. Okay, so just like the other one, I have a service in here. This is an OData service called Wingtip CRM service. What it is an OData service that wraps a database. So we're just doing reads and writes to a database as an OData source. And so in order to get that service running, I have to go ahead and start the project. And since the service is the default project, it's going to go ahead and start up. Okay, let's get that rolling. Just like the other one. This one's secured with Windows authentication, which really just gives me an excuse to tell you that you can use various forms of authentication with your OData sources. So Windows authentication is fine, tokens are fine, all of those are possible. And here we are back on a home page telling me my service is started. Now what we're going to do is go to a Breeze client here to navigate this information. So we've got, again, a SharePoint app that we've written to navigate this. Here's my Breeze client. Same kind of thing. Notice I got a little progress bar going up there. That's cool. So we're waiting for the data to come. Okay, there's the data. Now what I'd like to do is let's go ahead and remove all these and see if we're going to get this guy to work. And so what I'd like to do is refresh this page. Okay, there we are refreshed. And now let's come in here and, oh, here's what I want. Check it out. So you see the first call that went to OData $metadata? What happened here is Breeze went and pulled the schema for that OData source. That's what you see in the lower right-hand window. It said, what are the entities that you support, Mr. OData? And then it built for me the entity model on the fly after it got that. And then once it has it, now it can go back and say, okay, I understand what you've got. You've got a customer there. And now I can go ahead and do a get against that and pull the JSON back from it. So it's a 1-2 punch. Go get the schema, build the entities, and then go get the data. That's pretty cool, isn't it? That stuff is really nice. One of the reasons I'm super psyched about Breeze. Okay. So having seen that then, let's do a couple of other things. Let's go back to our little app here. Now, we're going to take a look at something else. So here we are. We've got the same kind of data we were working with before, and we can see Brandy has joined us. She's at the top of the list there. And I'm going to go ahead and do an edit against that record. So we click on this, and we bring up Brandy. And so Brandy currently has an I at the end of her name, which is sort of, you know, that's like the supermodel version of Brandy, right? You have the I at the name. So we're going to go ahead and put her back to like normal Brandy, the girl you might date in high school. We'll go ahead and put the Y on there and click update. And when I do that, I'm going to come over here to this little button that says save changes. I'm not going to click it yet, but I'm going to do control one, which will zoom it in. And you can see that there is one change in the cache right now. Breeze is tracking what I'm doing for me. It has not talked to the back-end database yet, but it's tracking what's going on, and it knows that I made an update. Okay, let's do another one. So now we're going to do is come in and do an add customer, and let's go ahead and add my name. So we'll do SCOT, which is the supermodel version of Scott. Yep, very important. H-I-L-L-I-E-R, great. We'll put some company information in there, great. Email. Scott@scotthillier.net. I'll give you my email, that's fine. I will not be giving you my home phone number. So 555-555-5555, great. And 555-555-5555. Did I get enough fives in there? It looks like I have too many somewhere. Let's see. There, we need three fives there and four fives there. Super, let's do an add. And now you can see that Scott's been added up here, right? See, I've done it more than once. And then if we come up here and do control one, there are two changes now. An add and an edit. And now what I'm going to do is go ahead and clear out Fiddler. Remove all that. Okay, and then we're going to come back to our Breeze thing here. We're going to go ahead and click Save Changes. And when I do, it runs. It comes back and it says, well, now there are zero changes. And if we go look at Fiddler, we'll see that there was a call to the batch endpoint. And if we look at the call that was made to the batch endpoint, let me try to move this window. Oh, terrible. There we go. If we look at the call that was made to the batch endpoint, let's just go ahead and put it in raw, and we'll put it in raw. There we go. We can see that what was sent over was Brandy's change, super, and then all the information for Scott. See that? All sent over as a batch. Now the database has been updated. I can open the database, but you believe me, it's back in the database. That's where the service put it. And that's what Breeze has to offer. I don't know. I feel like I should prompt you for applause. That, to me, is pretty cool. I sort of expected you would do it on your own. All right. Okay, so what do we want to look at in here? What code do I want to look at? Let's take a look at the script that actually does this. So I'm going to pop this guy open here. And we're interested in the view model library. All right. And now you can come in here and see that I've initialized the adapter. I've said what adapter I want. If you were paying really close attention, you'll notice this line of code is not the one that was in the slide, because this is the new line of code where they have created the web API OData adapter for us. So this is hot off the presses. This is the first time I know this is being demoed. So there's this new web API OData adapter that allows Breeze to work with web API services. Similarly, there's going to be one for SharePoint that you can use to work with lists and libraries. So you tell it what adapter you want. Then the next thing that you're going to do is tell the manager where the endpoint is, right? There's the endpoint. That's what allows it to go get the schema and hit the batch endpoint because it knows where to go. And then we could come in here and say, let's do like a load customers, right? And you can look here in the load customers, and you can see that we have two different options. One is to work against the local cache, which is done by calling the manager and saying execute query locally. And the second is to work against the back-end store, which is just to call directly to the back-end store. And so if we come down here and look at this thing, you'll see that regardless of whether I get the data from the cache or the back end, I'm going to bind it the same way here by just filling up a collection of customers and sending them on their way. When I do the save changes operation, then what happens is I just call manager save changes, which, if you've done Entity Framework, should feel very familiar to you, because that's the way Entity Framework works. It tracks changes, and then you tell it to perform the save. And then if that's successful, I'm going to clear that cash out and reload the customers right there. So I'm in complete control of when I talk back and forth. Okay? Okay, so that's the breeze. Let's jump back and look at some more. All right, so those are our two data layer patterns, data layer libraries we want to look at. Now what we're going to look at is what I call app pattern libraries, app pattern libraries. So app pattern libraries, I've chosen to show you model view, view model with Knockout, and model view controller with Angular. Now, why is it that I think these things are important? Again, I need you to buy into the idea that what's really changed is that everything now is going to be client over HTTP, and that that means that there's a tremendous amount of importance with JavaScript, and that we have to be able to write enterprise solutions with JavaScript, and that is simply going to be impossible without some kind of framework to work against. You are just not going to be able to successfully implement some kind of model view controller pattern without a framework. It's a nice theory, you know, you get an A in computer science if you did it on your own, but in the real world, we need something that allows us to produce consistent artifacts that I can give to you, that you understand how they work, all that type of stuff. So that's why the app pattern libraries are really important. The first one we're going to look at, many of you may have either used or have some familiarity with, because it's pretty popular in the SharePoint community right now, Knockout.js. Knockout is responsible for implementing the model view, view model pattern in JavaScript. You can get it through NuGet, or it has its own site, knockoutjs.com. And it has two key features to it, declarative binding and dependency tracking. The declarative binding allows you to bind information into HTML, and the dependency tracks when that data changes. We'll take a look at that in some detail. Here's a little visual on model view, view model. Basically, when we talk about this pattern, and really interestingly, I always feel like I could take this drawing and just change the names on here, and we would get model view controller or model view presenter. The idea behind all these patterns, whether they're MVVM or MVC or model view presenter, is primarily separation of concerns. When you're engaged in building enterprise applications, we all know that you have to be able to separate concerns. You have to make it so that one person can work on one piece, one person can work on another. A change in one component does not ripple through and affect others. And that's what we have here. So in the model view view model that we're going to see, the view model is responsible for reading and writing to the data source, whether that's a SharePoint list or a back-end database. The model is the actual object representation. So we're doing that transformation from that normalized data table or from those gets and puts into an actual object. So as always, I would just like a customer, I would just like a product. I don't really want to have to deal with how the data is stored. And so the view model will create one or more models that represent those entities and then pass them off to the view for display. As I said, Knockout has a couple of key features, the first being declarative bindings. So the way that this all works, and certainly the way that Angular will work as well, is that we take advantage of an HTML5 capability, which is called out here by these little data binds. See those? What HTML5 says is that you, as a developer, can place any additional attribute you want in an element as long as it starts with data dash, and it will properly validate. So all the browsers agree that as long as the attribute starts with data dash, it's valid HTML, and I won't cough up about it. Okay? But you can use this on your own to bind anything you want into an element. You can, you know, data dash my stuff. But Knockout specifically uses it to bind data that's coming back from objects. So you can see here we have this lovely syntax that says data bind, and then it says for each get contact. So there's some kind of an array here that I'm going to loop through. And then the objects that come out are going to have last names, first names, and phone numbers, and Knockout is going to create a table for me that has one row for each item that comes back from that array. On the code side of things, we have dependency tracking. So what's going on here, the way this works, is that Knockout allows you to create properties and arrays that it will track for you. It does that when you use its objects. They begin with KO, there's the Knockout namespace. So the one you're seeing here is a KO observable array. A KO observable array is an array of items that Knockout will track. It will bind these to the UI using the code that you saw in the previous slide. And then if the membership of the array changes, knockout redraws the page for you automatically. Let that sink in for a minute. There is no code to generate the page. Once those declarative bindings are in place, knockout tracks the membership of the array. The moment it changes, boom, redraw, redraw, redraw. So as you perform CRUD operations, the table just keeps getting redrawn, and you saw that kind of thing in the apps that I've been showing you already. They just, names just pop up all, and the experience is very fluid. Knockout also supports the idea of an observable, not an observable array, but an observable, which allows you to track the properties of an object. So if a first name changes or a last name changes, it will also trigger this redraw. Okay, so let's take a look at an example with knockout. Let me go ahead and get the code open here before we switch. Okay, so once again, what we're going to do is just take a look at the app, and then we'll come back and look at some of the code. Open up our browser here and go to link. Here's our knockout client. All right, so this is a pretty straightforward one. In fact, let me just go ahead and make this a little bit bigger so we can see in the back. That should do. Okay, so again, I'm just working with people information. I like to work with people information when I show these things just because it makes it easy. Everybody understands what's going on. And once again, you can see that we can perform creates, edits, and deletes. So I could come in here and, you know, add my information in here again. But what we're interested here is not the back end stuff, right? What we're interested in here is noting that what's happening is when this new thing gets added, yeah, it's going to do it. There it goes. You can see that, boom, it automatically redraws, right? So it happens instantaneously when the membership of that observable array changes. Same thing if I come in here and do a delete, the membership of the array changes, and boom, it redraws. So my job then is simply to change the membership of the array, not really to worry about the redrawing part of the thing. Okay, let's go look at code and see how that was done. Okay, so what I'm showing you here is just a SharePoint hosted app. So really everything we're doing in this is all JavaScript, right? So there's nothing going on but JavaScript. So I have a simple SharePoint hosted app here. And we'll go to our script section. And the first one I want to show you is wingtip.contacts.data. I'm going to go ahead and make that big, and here it comes. There it goes. All right. So I just want to show you that what's going on in here is no magic. So I have a library, JavaScript library, that performs CRUD operations. It simply is using jQuery AJAX against a contacts list in my SharePoint hosted app. Right. So nothing special here. These are just simple calls back. And then what I want to do is transform those simple calls into an object I can deal with. So what I've also got is another library here that just has a model in it. And this model just has ID, last name, first name, and phone number. So this is the representation of my contact or my customer or what have you, right? So already you can see that what I'm doing in this pattern is transforming. I've got all my data stuff isolated in a library, and I'm transforming that into a set of objects that I can deal with. And finally, we can make all of this work in the view model where all the fun happens. So here in the view model, if we go down to load items, you can see that I call wingtip contacts data read list, which will execute the get that I showed you in the data layer. It returns a promise, so when we're successful, it will come back to here. It will give us the data. We'll get back the data from the source, which this should look familiar to us, right? Data.d.results is how SharePoint gives us back results from a get. I have this contacts collection, and if we look at the contacts collection, It's defined as a KO observable array. That's the critical thing right there, is that array is a KO observable array, which means whatever I put into it, Knockout's going to look for changes in membership. That's the key part. So I'm going to come down here and clear everything out, and then I'm going to go ahead and push in instances of the model class that I just showed you. So I'm filling up that array with a bunch of customers or a bunch of contacts, whatever it is that I got back. Can you see all the layers in your mind of how we got this, all these concerns are separated now? And I could have somebody work on the data layer without having impact on other things. And so finally, what we need then to do is to bind this. So I'm going to come into the default.espx page here. And you'll see some familiar code, where I have the for each that does a get contact. So it's going to pull that KO observable array. And then it's going to create a row in the table for each one of the things in the array. So the only thing we don't have is how is this declarative stuff glued to the JavaScript. And the way the declarative stuff is glued to the JavaScript is through this wonderful line of code right here, ko.applyBindings. What ko.applyBindings does is it takes your view model and binds it to a particular element. In this case, we're asking to bind the view model to the results table. And if we go look at our page, we'll see that I have an ID in the body here called results table. So that's why this get contacts works, because Knockout binds my view model to that element, which can then perform these operations against it. So now, my question to you is, if you look at this code right here, what if I didn't want to show this as a table anymore like this? What if I just wanted to show it as a list? How hard would it be to make that happen? Pretty easy, right? All I have to do is change the HTML. That's all I got to do. That's the separation of concerns that Knockout brings to the party. And you can see the structure as I walked you through the data layer, the view model, the model, and into the Knockout bindings in the view, how there's good separation of concerns, and I could have a team of people working on this, and if there are changes to the product, it doesn't ripple through. This is really a lot different than most of the JavaScript that you and I had been writing in SharePoint prior to this point. But this is the skill that's critical now for you to be successful, because that's what the future looks like right there, all right? Okay, so that's Knockout. Oh, I'm glad you like it. Thank you. It's nice to know you guys are trainable. Good. All right, next. So now Knockout is really cool. A lot of people in here probably have used Knockout. Again, it's pretty popular in the SharePoint community right now. But what's important to understand about Knockout is that Knockout is a data binding library. Yes, it has some other capabilities to it, but you saw what it's really there for is that data binding. So the model view, view model pattern, most of the MVVM was me making libraries, and then binding the data to the view was where Knockout really helped me out, right? That glue between the view model and the view. Okay. But if we're really going to do enterprise stuff, if we're going to do serious knockdown, dragout apps that are all built in JavaScript, we need more than that. We need a real framework that encompasses the entire body of this application, not just a couple of pieces of it. And that's where Angular comes into play. Angular implements the model view controller pattern in JavaScript. You can get it from these places that you see right here. You can also get it from NuGet. It's always the easiest way to get it. What are the features it brings to the table? It brings model view controller, as I said. It does data binding, kind of like Knockout does. Different way to do it, but it does data binding like Knockout does. It does routing. If you're not familiar with the concept of routing, this is a very important concept to you. It's present not only in Angular, but it's present in ASP.NET MVC. It's present in ASP.NET Web API. And it says that we want to divorce the URLs that are typed into the browser from the location that that ends up going to. Let me try to explain. How many folks in here have written ASP.NET app? There you go. Raise your hand. Right? Okay. So ASP.NET. If I type a URL in the browser that's used with an ASP.NET web application, what does it always end with? ASPX, right? So ASP.NET implements this sort of page model idea, where you go to a page. Then if you want to do something else, like you're looking at the people and you want to add something, you add something, you go to another page and you add something, and then you come back. And if you want to edit it, you go to another page. And the destination is always a page. And right now, you have a paradigm in your mind that web-based programming has to end at a page. It's there. Whether you realize it or not, it's there, and we're going to get rid of it right now. There's no reason for that. What routing says is I want to divorce what you type in the browser from what you see. Why do I have to type ASPX? Why can't I just type HTTP, you know, /zebras, and you see the homepage? Why can't I do that? Because then I can create URLs that are much more meaningful. And when you consider RESTful services don't end at pages. They end at entities. So I want to ask for /customers. There's no ASPX to talk about. So here's the key thing. If I want a customer, why should it matter that I would like to see it in JSON and then I want to do something with it in JavaScript, that I would like to see it in XML and I'll do something else with it in JavaScript, or that I would like to see it as HTML and have the browser render it? There's no difference. It's just a form of the data, right? So what routing says is let's divorce that page model from the URLs that we put in, instead have an entity-based URL that we use. So Angular supports this idea of an entity-based URL and allows you to route it to functionality controllers within your system. Very cool, very powerful. It also supports the idea of directives, which is a declarative coding model, similar to the declarative stuff we just saw in Knockout, and something called factories, which allows you to create services and the like for your application, because there are plenty of times when we have to sort of break that nice model. Like, when you and I think about partitioning and separation of concerns, we think data tier, business tier, display tier, and that feels really good until something doesn't fit in one of those buckets, right? There are services that those layers may need. Angular recognizes that and allows you to create services off to the side that each of these components can consume, but they live in their own world. So extremely powerful. The point here is that we have a framework, not, you know, a library that does one or two things. It's a framework. Everything in Angular begins with this idea of a module. The module is the container for all of the framework that you're going to be creating and using. The routing allows you to map what's typed into the browser to what it is that you would like executed. The model view controller part of the show is actually down here in this area. You can see the controller, obviously. There's the view. The model in Angular uses something called $scope, so that's really the model. And basically what's happening is the controller is going to be responsible for reading and writing to the data. It's going to put that data in the scope, which will then transfer to the view where it's bound, right? So it's really, sometimes those Angular has a bunch of these $ things that can throw you off when you first see it, but the concepts are all really just standard model view controller type stuff. In fact, we can move to the next slide and look at model view controller with Angular, and you'll note that this is pretty much the same picture I showed you for model view view model with the names changed to protect the innocent. And then you'll see how we can create a model here like this. But that model is transferred to the view over here using the scope object. That's the magic right there. So the scope becomes like our view model. Do I have anybody here that's written an ASP.NET MVC application? Bet a few hands go up. You guys know what the view bag is, right? So if it makes sense to you, the $scope is the view bag of Angular. You can shove stuff in it and send it over to the UI for display, right? Beginning to understand Angular really starts with the idea of directives. Directives are based on that idea that I just told you in HTML5, where you can have something that begins with data dash, and it will validate as good HTML5. We saw how Knockout used that. Angular's going to use the same approach, and here are some examples. There are many, but here are some examples of directives that Angular uses. ng-app defines the scope of the framework. So you're going to go into a page, and you're going to say, my app controls this part of the page. Typically, it's the entire page, but it could be less. But typically, it's the entire page. Then ng-controller says, I'm going to write a controller, and the controller is going to control this part of the page. So apps have controllers in them. And then One of the places that Angular really shines is that, you know, Knockout is great at binding stuff to show you, but Angular is super good at allowing the user to interact and then mapping those interactions to methods in your controller code. So it says, like, a data-ng-click will map to a method in your controller that should be executed when a click event runs. So all of your code now is well encapsulated inside of these controllers, much easier to maintain. Let's take a look at some actual markup and see how that works. So here you can see I have some basic markup for an HTML5 document. And then you'll see the data-ng-app. Currently, the way that's written, it initializes an anonymous app, but it could be anonymous or named. That's all right, and we'll see that in the demo. You'll see I have an input there with the data-ng-model directive, which creates a property on the view model on that $ scope and promotes two-way binding. Two-way binding is critical for these enterprise applications because I need my controller to tell the UI what to display. But what if the user types something in the text box? How do I get it back? Well, the way that Angular does it is it binds it to the same $ scope. So what we're passing around is the $ scope, and it has all the context that's going back and forth between your controllers and the UI. Very powerful. Data-ng-click, as I said, references a controller method that should be called on the click event. And the ng-controller says what controller is in charge of this part of the page. Notice that in Angular, you can have the data dash or not have the data dash. Angular doesn't care, but HTML5 does care, so you should probably always use the data dash. Here's an example of data binding. Once you've said what parts of your solution are in control of what parts of the page, then you're going to want to be able to show information in the page. And the way that Angular does it is it uses the handlebar syntax. So you have these double French braces here, and this is the name of a property that can be found in the $ scope, in the view model. So there's a property in the view model called first name. That is what's going to be displayed here. Notice there's a data-ng-model directive that creates a first name property on the scope. This pretty useless code will show in the div whatever it is you type in the input. See how that works? That's two-way binding in action in the simplest form. Once you understand a little about data binding, you can go farther now so we can start to get into some programming and get some functionality going. And the first thing we're going to look at is modules. Remember, everything really begins with a module, the declaration of a module. So here you can see the Angular namespace, right? So angular.module. And I'm creating a module called MyApp. So that's really the largest container of functionality and scope that I have in this app that I'm creating. Additionally, if I have other modules, because you can have more than one, and there are many standard Angular modules, like a routing module, that may need to be referenced in order to use Angular, they would go in the array that you see that is currently empty. Once the Angular module is declared, then what you're going to do is you're going to reference the part of the page that that module is going to control, and you can see the ng-app. Controllers. Controllers are created by the module itself. So you'll notice that we have the myapp.controller. This defines a new controller. The name of the controller is the welcome controller. It's standard accepted Angular format to have the name and then a big C, TRL. Now, what happens is your controller, the scope of your controller, or the, you know, all the code you're going to write for this controller lives between that myapp and that semicolon right there. That's really important because it isolates and separates that and makes it maintainable. But the way that Angular makes sure that you don't have dependencies in your controller that are going to break the separation of concerns is that it uses a principle of dependency injection. Dependency injection says, if I have something over here with some functionality and I want it to be used by lots and lots of things, but it needs to know something about the thing before it can do something, I don't want to write knowledge of the thing into this component. The thing that uses it is going to tell it what it needs to know. Then it will run the code. That way lots of things can use it. Make sense? That's called dependency injection. And you can see it here in the code that I've written for you, where we're injecting the dollar sign scope, and that becomes the dollar sign scope variable in the function, and then I can access the dollar sign scope in the controller. So whatever you attach to the dollar sign scope, like in this case a welcome message, you can then go to a div and say, here's the controller that controls the content for this div, and doing so will cause your controller to run, which will then bind a welcome message into dollar sign scope, and you can use the handlebars to go ahead and bind it someplace inside the div, and that's where the welcome message will show up. Does that make sense? You got to do it a couple of times to get it, but it's actually, I think beautiful is not a not an unfair word to use. It's really well thought out. Okay, so let's take a look at an example of Angular in action here. And I'll go ahead and get the source code up before we switch over. Okay, so for this one, we're going to start with the source code. And just really to look at the project structure. So over here on the right, you can see the solution here. Now, I want to make you feel comfortable that this is just a SharePoint hosted app. It's nothing but a SharePoint hosted app. But it has a lot of JavaScript in it. And you can see that in my scripts library over here, what I've done is I've divided that stuff up so that it's easier to understand. So I have like a data layer in there. I have a folder full of controllers. The app start is where the initiation code is going to live. So all of this is really just JavaScript, but it's broken out into these folders to try and keep it straight. Now, for my MVC folks, you might actually recognize this folder structure because I follow the same folder structure that MVC5 uses for Model View Controller. And although I'm not going to do any MVC5 in here, I really want to point you at Bob German's session where he's going to be doing MVC5, because once you learn Model View Controller, you can use it all JavaScript and Angular. You can use it all C# and in ASP.NET MVC5 and learn one model in both places, right? So that's a very powerful thing to do. So I definitely recommend looking into the MVC5 stuff. All right, so before we dig into the code in any great detail, let's just go ahead and run the app here. Watching my time, I think we're just under 15 minutes. And let's grab the Angular one here, and we'll run that. All right, and so what we're going to see here is just some basic CRUD operations against a contact list. And one of the key things about the Angular library is that Angular implements this model view controller, but it really wants you to write what we call single page applications, or SPAs. Single page applications change the information that's on the page without actually changing the page. And I've demoed this in the previous session, but it's definitely worth looking at again, where if you come up to the URL, you can see that I'm on default.aspx in a standard SharePoint hosted app. But then what I'm going to do is come down here and I'll say, show me the next page, show me the next page, show me the next page. So I'm flipping through the pages inside of here, and you can see I'm staying on default.aspx. I'm not going anywhere. And I can do other things too, like I can come in here and say, let's go ahead and filter this list, right? I could add a new contact. And every single one of these things that I'm doing, I can edit a contact, right? Every single thing, one of these things that I'm doing is all happening in the same page. And what's happening in the Angular framework is it's redrawing that page based on what controllers are involved in the create, the read, the update, and the delete. And it just makes it all happen on the same page. So do you see how wonderful the end user experience is here? It feels a lot like I'm using a Windows application. I mean, it's highly responsive. It's not posting back. There's no unnecessary chatter. Now, I want you to really think for a second about combining this with Breeze. So now you have, under the covers, this incredible cash that's being managed for you and entity tracking. And on top of it, a single page that's dynamically being redrawn as somebody works through an enterprise application. That is where you're trying to go. That is what we're trying to make. And now, if you look at this framework and all these things I've shown you, hopefully you're getting some vision of how you could have your team work on different parts of it, and we could put it through a real software development lifecycle. Okay. So let's go take a look at just a couple of things here in the code so we can familiarize ourselves with some key things. First, under the app start, I have the good old app.js, which we all know and love from our SharePoint-hosted apps. And there really isn't much of anything worth talking about in here except where you see the definition of the module. There's the definition of the module right there. So everything begins in Angular by declaring a module. And then what you can do is, from there, you're probably going to define your controllers. So I'm going to take a look at, let's do something simple here so we don't get lost. If I come into this application again, you'll notice that one of the things it did, besides actually produce all these contacts, was it welcomed me and it actually gave me my picture. This is being pulled from your user profile, so that's another thing that we're doing here. And if I go look at the controller that I call the welcome controller, you'll be able to see some of this in action. So here is the definition of a new controller called the welcome controller. It injects scope into the controller, and then it comes down here and it says, let's go ahead and make a call to this data layer, and I call this function me, and I could go pull it for you, but it's basically a RESTful call to your user profile, which returns your display name and your picture URL. Those I bind to the scope, see it? So I go get your profile information, and I stick it on the scope. Then we can come back to default.aspx, and look at the declarative portion. Let me scroll down a little bit. Here is data-ng app, that's the module I defined, right? And here's the welcome banner right here, where I say the welcome banner is under control of the welcome controller. That causes the welcome controller to run, and then I can do your image, which says use the picture URL. And then I can welcome you by using your display name. Now I ask you, if I wanted to show this in a different way, what would I change? The HTML, right? And if I wanted to use not your user profile, but something from your HR department, you know, your HR system, I would just change the data layer, right? And that's what we're trying to achieve. So that's really where you're trying to get to with these enterprise applications. And that's what Angular is good for. All right, bringing it home now. The last thing we're going to talk a little bit about is responsive design libraries. So I have a couple in here that we're going to talk about. The first is LESS. LESS is really cool because what LESS does is it gives you enhanced CSS capabilities. And if I go to the next slide, we can kind of see what those are. On the left-hand side, you see the LESS CSS, and on the right-hand side, you see the resulting compiled actual CSS. So LESS is a superset of CSS, and we can do things like, if you look up here at the top, you'll see font size is 20 points and the color right there. And then what I can do is use those variables in places throughout my CSS. Yeah, I like that, right? Yep, and then you can see over here how it gets generated into CSS. And it has wonderful capabilities like that, not just variables, but you can also have a level of inheritance in your style. So you can say, this style is all of this style plus these other things. All the things you really wish you had as a professional programmer. That stuff is built into Visual Studio 2013. Go to your SharePoint-hosted app under your content folder where it says app.cs, CSS, and change it to app.less and have fun. That's all you got to do. It will compile the CSS for you from that point on. Last thing I want to talk about is Bootstrap. Again, Bootstrap was done in here in the previous session, but I'm going to touch on it here because I think it's so important. Bootstrap is about responsive design. Here's the homepage for it. You can also get it from NuGet. Basically what Bootstrap does, it does a bunch of stuff, but what I want to focus on is responsive design, which means that regardless of whether you're looking at your SharePoint app with a phone, a tablet, or a full screen, it's going to redraw itself in order to support that device. It does that by using something called media queries. Media queries allow you to ask the device what it supports. So what is your height and width? What's your orientation? What's your aspect ratio? And then you can associate styles with those particular elements so that you know I have a narrow width to deal with. I showed this before in the previous one, but these are some examples of using media queries. You can have a media query that binds to a brand new style sheet. So if this is a phone, use this style sheet. If it's a tablet, use this style sheet. You can put them inside the page, and you can also write JavaScript using window.matchmedia. We use those with the Bootstrap grid system. So Bootstrap is actually pretty easy conceptually to get your arms around, and here's what you need to know about it on day one. Bootstrap imagines a 12-column grid on your page, and you put stuff in this 12-column grid by defining divs and using styles like row and column. So basically, you're just making a layout table. But then you specify, based on the device that's looking at it, how these elements should behave when different devices come along. And what they primarily do is begin to stack on each other. So you have these 12 columns where you've put content, but then when you look at it on a tablet, they stack 6/6. You look at it on a phone, it stacks 1 and all the way down. It does this for you automatically. So if you use Bootstrap in your apps, you already support every device that people are coming with. And it's ridiculously simple to do. We're right at the end here, so I'm going to just show you the example here. And then we'll wrap. But we're going to go back to that same one that we were looking at before. This third-party one right here. So this third-party one is laid out with Bootstrap. We can bring up that default.aspx. Great, we'll hold on to that for a second and come back. And what I want to show you here is that this is, of course, the full screen view, but now what I'm going to do is shrink it down to a size that represents the phone, and look what happened. Yeah, right? I didn't do anything. If I make this thing big enough, right, boom, it comes back to this. Now notice also that, you know, I have the trash can for deletes and the edits right here, but I've chosen that it doesn't make sense for you to be able to get them when you're on the phone, so I don't expect you to add or delete. But you might still want to search, so I've left this capability in place so you can search, right? So that's what Bootstrap brings to the party. It lays out this 12-column grid. You can see it in the divs that are right in front of here, where you have class equals row, class equals column, and this is how many columns I'm spanning, 3, 6, 3, count them up, they add up to 12, okay? All right, so that's Bootstrap. Let's wrap it all up here. So in summary, what did we do? We took a look at a bunch of third-party libraries that I think really go to making true enterprise JavaScript apps, OData Access with Data.js, link style querying, and entity management with Breeze. Then I suggested to you that you really need to adopt and love either MVVM or MVC with Knockout or Angular. And finally, we took a look at some responsive design stuff with Bootstrap. These are my other sessions. The only one I really have left is building REST services. So if you want to talk about that with me, please come see me. Other than that, don't forget to do an evaluation for me. I really appreciate that. That's the way Microsoft knows how I did. I will hang out for a minute if you have questions. I'm done. Thank you very much.